now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Hello, and welcome to Wild About Pets. This is the place we'll be talking to leading authors and experts about household pets or wild animals. This week, we're going to be talking about snakes and iguanas. In order to make your listening experience more enjoyable, I have a companion website, wildaboutpets.net, that allows you to see photographs of the animals we will be talking about on the show today. To see these pictures while you are listening, just click the purple Look While You Listen button you see on the Talk Zone homepage. Do you like snakes? Are you in the group of people who are fascinated by them and think they are cool, or do you have a deadly fear of them? And how about iguanas? Do you know much about them or what they even look like? Now, I know some of you would never consider having a reptile as a pet, but I know there's others who are passionate about reptiles, as many children are. In fact, after some of the movies or television shows feature the large snakes or iguanas, many pet stores reflect an increase of sales of these two reptiles. But I have to say, I attended the Chicago Herpetological Society's Reptile Fest recently, and I was very surprised to learn that most of the reptiles I had seen there, and there were hundreds, had been rescued animals, meaning that they had been given up by the owners who just found it was just too tough to take care of them. So why is it so hard to care for reptiles? And why are so many of them being given up? And is there some unknown danger about having some of those large snakes that are rather popular? And if you do decide to have a reptile as a pet, what is critical for you to know? My guests today are both members of the organization, the Chicago Herpetological Society, and this is a volunteer organization that's dedicated to the education and conservation of amphibians and reptiles. My first guest today is Dan Nathan, also known as Dan the Iguana Man. Dan has been a volunteer member of the Chicago Herpetological Society since the 1980s, and his passion for reptiles started when he was a child, and he has 25 years of experience handling green iguanas. He speaks and shows his iguanas at the Peggy Notobart Museum in Chicago, Illinois, and at the Chicago Herpetological Society's Reptile Fest, which is the nation's largest reptile show. He has won best exhibit at the show with his green iguanas in 2007 and 2008. Welcome, Dan. I'm delighted to have you on the program today.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for having me, and I'm very happy to be here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Now, again, I have a number of pictures of Dan's iguanas on my website. So to see those, just click the purple Look While You Listen button on the Talk Zone show page, or you can access it through my website, wildaboutpets.net. Just go to the Look While You Listen button. And so, Dan, we're going to take a look at photo number one, shows one of the green iguanas. First of all, obviously, besides an iguana being a reptile, tell us, what are the characteristics of iguanas? Tell us about really what iguanas are.
Iguanas start out as these tiny, little, cute characters that are little more than a foot long, and they're real small when they're hatched, and they seem very cute and cuddly when you go and see them at a pet store, but they grow to be 6 feet long, and they do need a lot of care over the course of their life, so it's not something to take lightly. If you're considering taking an iguana, I would most certainly not go to a pet store to buy one, but rather come to the Chicago Herpetological Society and take one on as an adoption. I talked to my friends at the Herp Society today. As a matter of fact, they are bringing me three more iguanas this week, two little ones and a three-footer, which I already have homes for.
So it sounds like you, being Dan the Iguana Man, are highly responsible for any of the rescues or the ones that are brought in. So are you caring for them until they get adopted?
Absolutely. They go into the habitat that I have built in my room, which has been an evolution of 20 years of building to accommodate a large number of iguanas. It didn't start out that way. It started out as being a house for six of them. But some of my bigger, older guys passed away. As a result, I became more dedicated and wanted to take on more youngsters because I look at these youngsters and I see the potential, having seen the full lifespan of an iguana, and I see much more than what I'm looking at on any given day. So as a result, this habitat has been built to accommodate any number of iguanas for as long as I need to until I find homes for them.
All right, and let's go to picture number 5. And there I see a lot of your enclosures. And here you had entitled this Room for More, and this shows quite a few of them. I loved this photograph. Let's get right to it. What do iguanas need that probably a lot of owners are just not really aware of, Dan?
What you got to realize is where they come from originally. They come from a tropic zone. So they need a lot more sunlight than what average light bulbs can provide. They need to be in the mid-80s to 90s temperature-wise, and they need to have a clean, floored environment. In other words, iguanas defecate 2 to 3 times a day, and if it's just left to sit there and they sit in it, then they're getting infections from that. So the habitat that you're looking at, every one of those floors is a suspended floor with a drawer underneath it, so waste falls through and they don't sit in it. Plus, I come and I manage this daily, so if there's anything that's sitting out on a shelf, it gets cleaned up right away. So that way, we keep them as clean and as bacteria-free as possible.
Are these specially designed enclosures?
These are enclosures that began, it was an evolution. It started out as two habitats that were 2 feet by 4 feet, 6 feet tall. And as my big guy grew, I took the back panels off and turned it into a 4-foot enclosure. And as more came in, I opened up 2 doors and framed it into a 6-foot enclosure. And as more came in, I built the red and the green cage that you see in that pic and added that to the entire habitat. So there's multiple rooms for them to go in and out of, and there's doors. There's like 20 doors on this habitat, so they can come out of the brown cage and go into the red or green cage, for example.
Oh, that's fabulous. Like a big iguana habit trail, like I used to have for my hamsters.
It's a hotel for iguanas, but the whole thing, the philosophy for me with this is that suspended floors with drawers underneath, so that they don't sit in their own waste. An iguana will sit in its own waste. It'll climb up on another one, put its claw into the back of the other iguana. Mm-hmm. Now that iguana's got an infection in its back.
Sure. Now, in most pet stores, if someone just went into the average store and they, you know, picked up one of those cute little baby iguanas mm-hmm. and grabbed some, you know, whatever cage that they were sold, will it have that removable floor? Is it designed for the iguana mostly?
No, most of these are aquariums that, you know, you'd have to put a substrate down, and they sell you all this stuff like plastic substrates or pebble substrates, and none of this is good for iguanas because the pebbles can get in their food and they can eat that and then it can impact them. The grass substrates, they're very difficult to clean. That's why the suspended floor, it gives me the affordability of much easier cleanup inside the cage, and everything else falls through. Plus, one other thing, every shelf inside the cage, this is something I learned from my vet, is triple-coated in spar varnish. It makes it like a countertop that resists bacteria.
Oh.
Matter of fact, all the branches, everything in there is spar varnish, so no bacteria can settle into it, so it's easy to clean up.
Well, now, Dan, did you build these yourself?
Yes, this is something that, again, was an evolution. I didn't plan on this whole thing being here. But it was a case of, if I build it, they will come. I built it, and they're still coming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Maybe out of control. Well, okay, so now wait a minute. We're hearing that it's crucial to have the right kind of enclosure. You build these. How do you happen to be able to build these? And if you build these, do you do this for a living?
Okay. I work in an antique store. It's called BJ Furniture and Antiques on Western Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Family owned and operated business for more than 50 years. They're located 6901 Northwestern. Phone number 773-262-1000.
Okay.
Now, I've been working there for 30 years, and they have a complete woodworking shop in the basement, which I set up myself. And over the course of time, I started building these cages out of necessity. And the necessity grew, and I just kept building. And it is a combination of two passions, iguanas, herpetology, and woodwork. And this is the ultimate outcome of that combination of passions.
Okay, so I understand, you know, at your shop, which obviously you're building other furniture, this is not just to build iguana enclosures,
right?
But can people come and buy an enclosure from you?
This is something that, you know, each one of these habitats took so long to create that it is not something that I did as a money-making venture, but just really as a labor of love to make something that these animals could live, thrive, and survive in. And the habitats that you see in the front of that picture are all collapsible. Those are the ones I took to Reptile Fest. All that can fold down and fit in my Camry. so I could take it anywhere and set up and do a show with it.
That's ideal. So, Dan, we have just found out from you the kind of enclosure one has for an iguana is crucial, and the kind that we are seeing, you know, are the ones that most people would want. If they can't buy them from you, where could someone go to find the actually proper enclosure for an iguana?
There's a lot of cage builders out there. If you look online, there's a lot of like high-end stuff, and there's a lot of, you could buy something called a ferret cage, Marshall Mansion, for example, which has a tray that pulls out on the bottom. So that would be a fairly easy cleanup. If they dump, you pull the tray, you roll newspaper, you clean it, roll it, play it back in. And so that's an easy way to do it. If somebody wanted to tackle building their own, an easy way to do it would just be to make frames lined with chicken wire and have legs coming off the bottom of the cage, and you could slide a tray underneath it. You don't have to do anything as elaborate as what I've got here, and it would be effective, just as effective as these.
Okay, great. Thanks for that tip. Let's talk a little bit more about their needs, and then we'll talk more about the natural history of the iguanas.
Sure.
So you said that there's quite a few things that it's critical to provide that often people are unaware of. I know when you and I were chatting, you were mentioning the light, the heat, and the food is all important. So let's talk about those.
Again, realize where they come from. They come from a tropical region where they get really strong sunlight. They're in the 80 to 90 degree range most of the day, and all the plant life that they need is all around them. So to duplicate that at home, you need the right kind of ultraviolet lighting, which needs to be changed every 6 months. And you can notice this because after 6 months' time, you'll notice the pattern on your animals start to fade. The stripes aren't as vibrant. Change those bulbs out, and you'll see the stripes all of a sudden jump, and they become more vibrant, like if they were in the natural sunlight. Good heating light or basking spots where, like hot rocks or heat pads. There's a lot of controversy about that. Some people don't like them because the hot rocks can tend to fry. You know, they can burn up.
Mm.
But Valentine heat plates are very good. And good basking spotlights is what I highly recommend. As far as the lighting and the heating, that's good. One other thing I did to make it better for my guys here, because they're in a basement bedroom. It's cooler down here typically in the summer. My heat guy put an extra heat vent right off the main duct directly into my habitat. So they're getting a blast of hot air every time we turn on the heat. And that upped the heat in this room from 72 to 82 degrees.
Warm.
Yeah, it's toasty.
Okay, by the way, my phone lines are open right now, so if you'd like to join our conversation and ask Dan a question about iguanas, call 888-463-6748. Again, that's 888-GO-FOR-IT. And also, there are photographs of the iguanas we are speaking about, and you can access those photos by clicking the purple Look While You Listen button on the Talk Zone Home show page.
Cool.
Well, let's go talk a little bit more about the
feet. Talk about the food, if possible.
Oh, yes, that's right. Thank you, Dan. And then we'll talk about the features of the iguana. Yes, tell me about food.
I've been dealing with iguanas for 25 years. For the first 10 years, they were getting the wrong food, okay? We didn't have access to the Internet back then like we do now.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great source of information for the right diet for green iguanas. My mainstay, my five main greens that I give them, collard green, turnip green, mustard green, endive, and dandelion. That's just the greens. Now, I'll use that as a base, and I'll mix on top of it snow peas, grape tomatoes, squash on any one given day, and then fruits on any other given day. And then I give them a supplement, a fiber supplement that I make, which is made out of iguana, adult iguana pellet food, which you can buy at a pet store, and alfalfa blocks, which are made for rabbits. But it's a great source of fiber. So what I do is I take these two elements, and I blend them in a food processor until they're a super fine powder. I can take that powder then, pour it in a bowl, pour water on top of it, and turn it into a slurry, and then pour that on their greens. Now, that is super food. With any new green iguana that I have gotten in, within a month of being on that diet, they've doubled in girth.
And in the bowl, there's a like kind of a peach-colored bowl. It looks like, I don't know, it's maybe a foot and a half. And there's quite a few, maybe four or five iguanas sitting in it.
Uh-huh.
And we're looking at picture number four.
Right.
Is this the bowl that has this greens and slurry mixture in it?
That's their food bowl. I use a small bowl to do the slurry and then pour that on top of the greens, mix it all together. And another thing is, like, when you give them their food, some people like to give them an individual thing here, an individual thing there. I take everything that I put in their bowl, and I cut it up real fine, mix it all together, put that slurry on top of it, mix it again. So when they're getting one bite, they're getting everything.
That is great. And it sounds like this is not the kind of food that one would normally walk into a pet store and commercially be able to
purchase. This is something that I learned through members of the Chicago Herpetological Society. While I was doing a speech, somebody, a good member who's no longer with us, chirped in and says, oh, you also want to add this, this, and this. After that meeting, I went home and I got online, and I completely changed the realm of their diet. And this was like 5 years ago, 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I had taken in a young adoption at that time, a little hatchling. She is now the matriarch of my clutch. Her name is Nina, and she's big as a house, better than a football. And she's only 5.5 years old, so she's going to grow for another 5 years.
Oh, that's right. So wait, what is their life expectancy, Dan?
My old guy, Anthony, went 23 and a half years.
Oh, that's quite a long commitment. And is that average for iguanas?
Typically 15 to 20 years, if they're cared for well. This one, he was an exceptional animal in that his beginning of his life, his metabolism was very slow. I fed him every third day or so. Now, these guys here, they're big pigs. They get fed every day. I reintroduce the food after they're done eating, and they'll eat more. You can't put too much food in front of a green iguana. You make them healthier by doing so.
Okay. Well, let's get to why so many of them wind up in shelters. And why do people have such a hard time keeping them healthy, Dan?
Okay, here's a biggie. When you go to the pet store, you see this cute little iguana, and it's like $20, and it's a foot long, and the aquarium's like another $20, $30. You come home with this nice setup. And you think, great, okay, it's good. What a lot of people aren't getting is the right information on heat, light, and food. And as a result, these young ones, they come in, and within a few months, they develop problems. They develop a metabolic bone disease because they're not getting enough light. And that creates a thing called rickets, where their bones start to curl and turn. And all of a sudden, the owner's feeling a little uncomfortable about, here this animal's sick, I don't think I'm doing the right thing. I need to move it along, And so a lot of people just let them go. Other people take them to the pound where they end up, left for dead. And if they get taken to the right pound, however, my friends at the Chicago Herpetological Society get a call, and they come and get these animals. And I walk into the next herp meeting, and there's a box sitting there, and they go, hey, Dan the Iguana Man, here you go.
Uh-huh. Another one.
Again, another adoption.
So then would people be able to call Chicago Herp Society and say, I would like to adopt one, and they can come to the center and learn more about iguanas?
Absolutely. Okay. The Herpetological Society meetings are held at the last Wednesday of every month at the Peggy Notabert Nature Museum, which is at 2430 North Cannon Drive. If you take Lakeshore Drive to Fullerton, get off on Fullerton, it's the first right you can make. And you look immediately to your left, and there's the Nature Museum. Last Wednesday, 7 o'clock in the evening, we hold the general meeting. If you go up to the third floor, they have adoptions galore every month. There's turtles, frogs, snakes. They say they don't take iguanas because if they did, there'd be like 100 of them there.
Mm-hmm,
but my
boy.
Friends, they get a call from the pound, and they go get them, and they bring them because they know I'm gonna find homes for them. And
okay.
They got three more waiting for me next week. So
okay, cool. I'm going to want to talk about some of your wonderful rescue stories, and we have three of your named iguanas. But before we get to that, I heard you say that some people just let them go. Are you talking about that they are just released into somebody's backyard or into the wild?
This is the case of Shiloh. One of my green iguanas was found running loose in the Chicago neighborhood in October. And was picked up and taken to the pound. And she was left for dead. I mean, she was literally skin and bone when I got her.
Sure. Okay, so what is the real problem, Dan, with people doing that, just saying, I can't take care of it. It should be able to fare fine. I'll just let it go, and I'm sure it'll find its own food and water.
It's a lack of the right knowledge of where to go. I mean, there's other sites out there that could help you adopt them out. There's a site called the Green Iguana Society. And if you go on there, there's, at any given time, 10,000 green iguanas up for adoption in Illinois alone.
Oh, that's an amazing amount. So
yeah.
Do I infer that iguanas really may not be the most realistic pet if so many are given away?
This is true. I mean, you need to have dedication and commitment to it. It's a daily job, and it's a job that can last for decades. So, I mean, unless you're willing to do that, I mean, first of all right, what are you going to do if you want to go on vacation? You need to find room and board for it, or you need to take it with you? Okay.
Right, because I hear the daily maintenance.
Right. What do you do if you got 15 of them?
Well, hopefully most people would not.
I don't get on many planes, let's put it that way.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
Vacation, sometimes they come with me. You know?
All right. So obviously online, and it sounds like if anyone is unsure if, you know, they should give in to their children clamoring for an iguana, the first thing people must do is learn a lot more and research this animal is what I hear you saying.
Information online is definitely helpful. You can get all the good information you need online to help make that decision if you want to take one on or not. But realize they do get to be 6 feet. And, at that point, they're a handful. But, if you have your habitat set up right, it can be a very easy thing to deal with. Not for everybody, okay? You got to have dedication to it.
Sure. Now, I do have the link to the Chicago Herpetological Society's website. And also, the society recommends a really great article, and I have that link also. That's at the bottom of the page of photos, entitled, So You Think You Want to Get a Reptile. I would definitely refer people to that. But let's look at picture number 6, and let's talk about Shiloh. What was Shiloh's story?
Shiloh, this is the one that was found running loose in a neighborhood in Chicago, and she was taken to the pet store, the pound, where my friends at the Chicago Herpetological Society got a call, and they brought her to me in a box. And when I opened that box and pulled her out, what I pulled out was this skin and bone, totally gray, limp arms hanging down next to dead green iguana. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I got to try. Look at her face, and she reminds me of Diesel, a beautiful male that passed last year at the age of 7. And so I really fought tooth and nail to save her life. And so I had to bottle feed her for 6 weeks before she would take her first bite of food. Mm-hmm. After that, when she started eating, within a month, she doubled in girth, and I got her on that good fiber diet. All of a sudden, color and pattern started to emerge, and her liveliness came back. She started to be more active. Within 3 months, she tripled in girth, and she showed her sign of being well by actually jumping on me from, 3 feet away. She'd jump right up on me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the Chicago Reptile Fest that we did, I had her there. She's sitting on a table. She jumped on a half a dozen different people during that show. It was great to see her just jump up and land on somebody's shoulder. I'm like, wow, that's a sign of full circle. It brought her back all the way. That's a real success story, and it was not easy to do.
And how about Tara? This is photo number 7, another rescued iguana.
Tara, okay. This is the one found in November. My friend has a pet store. My friend Michelle goes to work one day, and she finds a box sitting in front of her pet store. She opens it up. There's 2 green iguanas in there, both skin and bone, same kind of situation. She kept them for a couple weeks and nursed them, then she gave them to me. When I got them again, skin and bone, same kind of thing. These guys were eating on their own, but they had, there was Grace, Tara and Grace. Grace had a bad mouth infection and a big bump on her chin. I cleaned out that mouth infection by scraping off what was in there and applying Neosporin daily for a couple of weeks and to the outside of this big bump on her chin. The infection cleared up in 2 weeks, and that bump on her chin fell off and cleared up in another week, totally healthy. She ended up getting given to a friend of mine, Lawrence, at the Chicago Herp Society at the December meeting. So she got adopted out, and Tara I kept. Now, Tara, I'm looking at her now. She's almost as big as Nina. She's huge. Her body size has tripled in girth. She's totally healthy, and she's cantankerous with the youngsters, and it's just another sign of seeing it come back full circle.
And how about Leon? I can't tell if Leon's sleeping.
Yeah, he's sleeping on the footboard of my bed, okay?
Okay?
There's a heating pad underneath my hoodie there, and every night after the shower, he'd come and he'd march over by the bed. I'd put him on the bed. He'd climb up over and put his head on the footboard, watch TV, and fall asleep. His story is an interesting story. When I went to that December meeting, I came with 13 green iguanas with an eye on giving one away to Lawrence and coming home with 12.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, my friends, who usually bring me ones, brought me another one. And then my good friend Deb Crone, who is a member of the Herp Society, talked to me earlier about giving me Leon to watch for 3 months while she was in the process of a move. And I'm like, sure, no problem, I'll take him. And so I had him for, 4 months, actually. And now it comes to Reptile Fest. And I have him there with all the rest of my guys. And there were some people, veterinary people, came over. And Leon had his back, black spot on his tail. It looked kind of ugly. And I'm like, hey, what's this? And they looked at it and they go, oh, that's bad. If that is allowed to continue, that's going to grow into the bone. It's going to go up and it's going to kill him. So I go get Deb, who's in the room, and I say, look, here's what's going on with Leon. he's got this problem and it's going to kill him. She's like, oh, she looked like, oh, you know what? I thought that might have been a possibility. I'm going to take him to my vet. So she scoops him up and takes him to her vet. Now, before this, prior to this, she had told me, she's like, you know what? I'm going to give you Leon because he's so good with you. Mm-hmm. He sleeps on the bed at night. He's better off with you, right? So then this happened. So she took him to the vet. They amputated part of the tail. They mm-hmm. saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
Now she calls me up and says, you know what? My family has, like, rebonded with Leon, and would you mind if I keep him? I'm like, no, that's great. I'm happy to just be a part of it. You know, we saved his life, and now he's going back with you? Excellent. I've done my job.
Now, if iguanas come from the tropics, of course, they're animals that would normally live outside. Do you try and get these animals outside?
Every chance I get. Mm-hmm. I have a side door to my house, and I'll grab them all up, and I'll, you know, nice warm days, like the last couple of days, took them out, throw them all in the yard, and, you know, gotta keep your eyes peeled. When you got that many running around, it's easy to lose containment.
I would think so.
I have an iguana-proof yard. I got 6-foot fence all the way around with fence boards all around the base of it, so they can't climb under. But they sure can climb over.
Dan, where are the iguanas actually coming from that are showing up in the pet stores? I mean, are these captive-born?
These are breeders that are breeding them, you know, and bringing them up and selling them to pet stores. And then the pet stores, you know, underfeed them, and then what you get is a sickly iguana for $20.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to work really hard to save its life. And if you don't know anything about them, it's a difficult uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. Now, are iguanas at all endangered in any of their, you know, natural countries? Or what is, I guess I'm somewhat concerned about, you know, the exotic pet trade. And is there anything that you can, you know, say about that?
Oh, yeah. Certain places, they farmed, or I should say, hunted iguanas almost to extinction. But what we taught these people in these areas is that, hey, you're better off farming. So you take these females, you bring them in, you take the eggs, instead of eating them all, you take some and you hatch them out and put them back into the wild. And this way you have more for the future. So now these people in these countries have learned to farm iguanas and take part, but not all, of what they're catching so that they can have future generations.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very important. And I know iguanas are highly, highly popular animals. But if we, you know, and if you guys can do anything to get that information out about, you know, one, you know, are you aware of what you're doing? If you're going to purchase one and take it on, and then
you're in for, it's not like into next year, it's into the next decade and beyond. So, I mean, that's the thing. You know, people, there's a lot of impulse buying. Oh, it's cute. Let me have it, you know. But then in a year, they're like, oh, God, what did I get myself into? Oh, let's get rid of it. And that's why so many animals end up, you know, in the pound or worse. So, you know, we can only do so much. I mean, I can't take 100 iguanas in here, obviously. But
no.
I'm taking enough to, you know, fill this habitat up big time and have my hands full. But, and you know, with an eye on moving some along to good friends.
Yes, well, obviously we'll know now that if there's any interest in getting an iguana, to contact, if you're in the Chicagoland area, the Chicago Herpetological Society. Otherwise, if you're in a different state or somewhere around the world, you know, go online and find out, you know, what organization you could adopt one from.
There's lots of sites, but the Green Iguana Society is one that I actually used, and I adopted an iguana a couple years ago. And it worked out well. I mean, it's a process where if you find one you like, you contact the owner, and the people at the site will help link, you know, make sure that everything's on the up and up and link you together, and then you meet the owner and work things out.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. My guest today has been Dan Nathan, also known as Dan the Iguana Man, and he has been a volunteer member for the Chicago Herpetological Society since the 1980s. You can contact him through the Chicago Herpetological Society. We are going to take a short break. Please stay tuned, because we'll be back with my second guest, who's going to be talking about the large snakes. Stay tuned.